Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My name is Samantha Garner, and I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a Cheeselandian because I take cheese seriously, just like they do in Wisconsin. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
This episode is supported by Angry Orchard. HRN is teaming up with them to host a virtual event all about American cider. Check it out at heritageradionetwork.org/cider.
Hello, this is Lisa Held, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. The American agricultural system was built based on the enslavement of African people, and the persecution of Black people within agriculture did not end with emancipation. Systematic discrimination against Black farmers via land theft and exclusion from USDA loan programs has persisted over the past century. In 1920, close to 1 million Black farmers made up about 14% of America's farmers. In 2017, less than 50,000 Black farmers remained, making up just over 1%. Today's guest is Dania Davey, an attorney who has spent much of her legal career advocating for Black farmers. And we're going to be talking about the overall history as well as the work she and others are doing to right some of these wrongs. Dania has worked closely with Black farmers to prevent the loss of their homes and land. She produced the documentary Our Land, Our Lives, The North Carolina Black Farmers Experience. And she co-authored and edited the resistance chapter in the book Land Justice, Reimagining Land, Food, and the Commons. And she recently joined the Federation of Southern Cooperatives as the Director of Land Retention and Advocacy. Dania, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. And this will actually be the first episode of our summer 2021 season. So I'm glad to have you here to kick off our new season. So thanks for joining.
Of course. Thank you.
So I chose to start with that one sort of commonly cited statistic on the declining number of Black farmers in this country. But there's a lot of other data. There's a lot of other statistics I could have chosen. Can you give listeners a little bit of background on the scope of land loss that Black farmers have experienced in this country?
Absolutely. And you did a really great job kind of referring to the most frequently referred to data that's out there. And the way that I think about it is that, you know, when the Constitution was drafted, all the Black farmers at that time were legally classified as property. And then it wasn't until the 14th Amendment was passed that their legal status changed from property to a human citizen. So that in and of itself, being classified as property and then becoming, having the ability to acquire and own property, is a huge shift in the trajectory of the enslaved Africans who are now the Black and African American community that we have today. We at the Federation look at the Census of Ag because, as you said, there's lots of different data that's out there that measures either land ownership, farmland ownership, timberland ownership. So we kind of cite to the U.S. Census of Ag, where from, as you said, emancipation until 1910, 218,000 Black farmers accumulated 15 million acres of land. By 1992, we saw that 18,000 Black farmers owned 2.3 million acres of land, which represents over a 90% decline in both Black farmers and Black-owned farmland.
That's crazy. I mean, a 90% decline. It's just, it's insane. So what are some of the most common reasons that Black farmers have lost their land historically and you know, continuing to today?
So there's a long list of reasons, and it kind of follows a path through history, being the most extreme and to today being a little bit more subtle. And so we saw, originally and still to this day, it remains the issue of race-based discrimination in both sales and lending. You referred to the USDA discrimination that took place. But yes, so sales and lending still remains an issue facing Black farmers that causes them to not be able to acquire as much or maintain as much land ownership. There's also been a long, long history of racially motivated exploitation of legal means to acquire land. And by that, I mean adverse possession or squatter's rights and eminent domain. You might have seen that case out of California where that family recently regained access to land that was beachland. We've seen that all along the East Coast for Black landowners as well, losing a lot of prime real estate along the coastland. We also have seen limited access to legal services as a result of racial discrimination in both education and just access to those services. Air property is probably the biggest ticket item when it comes to the explanation for how Black farmers lose their land. And what air property is when a landowner dies without a will or some means of an estate plan, the state decides how their land is distributed amongst their heirs. So each living heir of that person will own and share interest in the entire tract. And so there's been a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding about what that means. So there are people that think I'm the 10th child of this person, so I own 1/10 of the one acre of a 10 acre tract. And no, you own a 1/10 interest in 10 acres of land. So the fractionated land interest among the heirs results in a whole host of problems, such as people not paying their equal share of taxes, that tax burden falling on the one heir that lives and farms the land. And if they're unable to do so, there's been a long history of tax sales resulting in lower prices for the landowners, as well as partition sales. And partition sales is another major, major contributor to land loss. And what a partition sale is that any heir, because they own an heir interest in the property, they can sell their interest. And so if someone sells outside of the family, for example, and that non-family member says, hey, I don't want to manage this land with all of these strangers. I want this property to be sold so that I can get my partition share of the sale. And so there are people who were land speculators that kind of strategically identified vulnerable properties that were heir-owned and really took advantage of the partition sales laws to be able to acquire large tracts of land for very, very little, pennies on the dollar.
Right. So there's a lot, just all these different factors. And I do feel like heirs property, that's gotten more attention. There's been a lot of stories about that in the past few years. Is that sort of the most prominent cause of land loss, or do you think it's just the one that has so far sort of been covered the most widely?
Well, back 40 plus years ago, back in 1980, the Federation of Southern Cooperatives was, Congress asked us to conduct a study about heirs property and its impact on Black farmland ownership. And that kind of became the basis for a lot of the inquiry, research, and legislation around heirs property. That's part of, you know, what kind of laid the foundation for the Uniform Heir Property Partition Acts that have been getting passed in the various states. So I do think that there are ways in which the heir property issue has been brought to the public's attention, but the other issues around discrimination in lending, especially the ongoing problems that farmers regularly have with accessing USDA programs. The 2018 Farm Bill, as an example, had legislation language specifically around addressing the unique needs of heir property owners and Black farm owners. And some of those provisions have not yet been implemented. So I think that the discrimination in lending, the discrimination or actually the social discrimination in terms of the rural community's access to legal services and attorneys continue to play an ongoing role in the issue of land loss as well.
Right. Okay. So, you know, these are big issues, big challenges, and a lot of times when we talk about them, they sound, you know, it's in the form of statistics or kind of explaining how these complicated legal things happen, right? But you've worked closely with farmers and families who are fighting to keep their land. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what this issue looks like on a human level. Like, can you give some examples of how families are affected?
Absolutely. I mean, a very obvious example for me is the executive director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, Cornelius Blanding, shared in his remarks to Congress that as a result of air property issues, he was personally, you know, his family had to leave the land that they owned and had to grow up in kind of the traditional, you know, poverty scenario of subsidized housing and you know, government support. And I can tell you that when I took my documentary on the road, I had screenings of it all over the country, from California all the way across the Southeast. And there's never a time where I don't meet someone who is African American who doesn't have some experience of either a family member losing land because of the air property issue or because of racial discrimination in some other form, or they were the beneficiary of their family being able to hold onto the land because they were able to keep the land. Then, you know, two of my closest friends from law school, they are grandsons of farmland owners. And so we see the opposite in that when we really support Black farmers and give them access to markets where they can be they can, you know, manage their wealth and create wealth for generations, then we see that the exact opposite, where we input support and invest in Black farmers, then we see the benefit of our society having more educated and professional people that are benefiting from Black farm wealth.
Yeah, absolutely. So this past year also brought new challenges, right? We're in a global pandemic, still are. And, you know, it's I guess we're kind of seeing maybe a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's still, you know, the impacts are certainly going to remain for a very long time. Have you seen evidence of the pandemic exacerbating this particular issue, like, you know, interacting with this already existent challenge related to land loss for Black farmers at all?
Absolutely. That's a really great question. And as I referred to that 1980 study that Congress commissioned, we see that a lot of those issues kind of remain unchanged, even with the evolution of legislation that should be having a more direct impact on the loss of land slowing down. We really haven't seen that yet. And in reliance on the Census of Agriculture, we know that the average age of the Black farmer is above 65, which coincidentally puts them squarely in the vulnerable position with regard to both race and age in terms of the COVID risk factor demographics. And so, as you can imagine, as we've already addressed with a lack of estate planning, that is an extremely vulnerable position to see what the remaining Black-owned farmland is owned by people that are extremely vulnerable because of COVID in particular. And so we've actually done a COVID needs assessment of our membership to get a better understanding of the impact of COVID, and as well as the impact of the heightened awareness around racial injustice. And we're really trying to take that data and implement it in ways that will address that issue, that yes, we're going to see a need for a lot of legal services and legal support for estate planning for these families. But what I'm excited about in terms of the what's going on in our tumultuous lives today is that there's a lot of awareness and education that what we're really seeing in terms of Black Lives Matter, we're really seeing a resurgence of the fact that we never adequately as a country adjust Jim Crow and the enslavement of African Americans. And so because of that history and because our legislation has never appropriately cut the root, what we're seeing is the branches of all of that white supremacist oppression for the farmers continuing to this day. And so what I'm hopeful is that with this heightened awareness, people will actually understand, you know, the Federation has been in existence since 1967, and we're proud beneficiaries of the civil rights movement. We're born out of work of the civil rights movement. And so that legacy, I think, is something that the work that's being done today can really build on and leverage the lessons that we've learned as an organization to survive all the eras of discrimination that we faced.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk more about that legacy and also the work that you're going to be doing in the future. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. My name is Samantha Garner, and I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a Cheeselandian because I take cheese seriously, just like they do in Wisconsin. Cheeselandia is a community for loud and proud cheese lovers brought to life by Wisconsin Cheese. I know that I can always cook amazing food with their cheese, and it's even good enough just to snack on. As a Cheeselandia member, I know there is always a supportive community behind me who always gets as excited as I do about cheese. Go to cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up. Check us out on Instagram at Cheeselandia.
This episode is supported by Angry Orchard. I'm Jimmy Carboni, host of Beer Sessions Radio, and I'll be moderating an amazing virtual event with Angry Orchard and Heritage Radio Network on May 26th. We'll be celebrating the release of the new first-of-its-kind book, American Cider, A Modern Guide to a Historic Beverage. I'll be in conversations with the authors, Daniel Pucci and Craig Cavallo. Then we'll welcome Angry Orchard head cider maker Ryan Burke for myth busting about this beverage and an interactive cider tasting. When you order a ticket, you'll also receive a copy of the book. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/cider. Plus, you'll find a link to purchase a hand-selected cider bundle from Angry Orchard so you can taste along with us. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/cider.
All right, this is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Dania Davey. She's the Director of Land Retention and Advocacy for the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. Dania, you mentioned the legacy of the Federation, but for those who don't know it, can you just talk a little bit about that legacy? What is the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, and what does its work look like today?
Absolutely. So the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund stands on a long and rich legacy of the civil rights movement and the related Black cooperative development movement. We were chartered in 1967 and remain the oldest and largest Black farmer-owned institution in the country. Our membership consists of Black farmers, cooperatives, landowners, and associates. Our current work today builds on all of that very, very difficult work. And I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that I'm just a beneficiary and standing on the shoulders of some very, very committed and dedicated people throughout history that have made it even possible for me to sit here and have this discussion with you today. And so we have that fantastic history that we're a part of, and I'm excited that we continue to do the work. And so the focus of our work today is primarily developing cooperatives and credit unions for people to improve their quality of their lives as well as their community. communities. We also want to save and protect and expand the land holdings of Black family farmers in the South and that of their families. We want to expand our unique and effective rural training and research center, including our 1,300-acre exhibition farm and registered forest, so we can continue to provide information, skills, and awareness to to building stronger rural communities. We also want to develop and advocate support for policies that directly benefit our membership, Black farmers, other family farmers, and low-income rural communities.
So, a lot. You're doing a lot.
Yeah, I could go on, but I thought I should stop.
Just a few simple tasks to get done.
Yeah, no big deal.
So I want to ask you more about your role in particular. But before that, it just occurred to me that, you know, I think it's interesting that the Federation is so focused on cooperatives. And like, why is that? Like, what is it that makes a cooperative kind of an effective model for agriculture, and particularly for, you know, these groups of farmers that you work with in the South? Like, I'm just curious about the cooperative model and why it's so important to what you do.
Absolutely. I'm originally from Jamaica. And so for me, the reason that cooperatives really stand out to me, I'm the granddaughter of a Chinese immigrant to Jamaica who definitely participated in a collaborative cooperative market to have grocery stores throughout the island of Jamaica. So for me, on a very personal level, I think of the ways in which communities that pool their resources can withstand global pandemics. They can withstand discrimination in lending and practices that would be very, very detrimental to an individual landowner or business owner, agribusiness owner, in their development of their wealth creation models for their families. And so I've seen it on a personal level, but I think in the history of the Federation, what we saw was that Jim Crow was very effective at taking out individual communities, Black Wall Streets. We see with Rosewood and different Black sustaining communities that were isolated because they could be targeted in isolated ways. But when folks join forces, they're able to better withstand all the economic and racial injustice pressures against their success. And so I think the cooperative model really is a really great model for representing the diversity amongst our membership, as well as the ability of our membership to withstand all of the historical and present day attacks against their individual autonomous success.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think I've read a few articles too about how I think potentially the pandemic might sort of lead to a little bit more emphasis on co-ops. I think people are looking for kind of more resilient ways to band together and produce food, and co-ops seem to me to be sort of an underutilized model, and especially in agriculture, a lot of the bigger co-ops are not really co-ops anymore, but the kinds of co-ops you're talking about are like just really people that have banded together in a way that gives them power and stability, right? In a way that you don't have on your own. So you're working on land retention. What are some of the most effective strategies that you plan to focus on in your role at the Federation?
So one of the things that I'll be focusing on is really addressing all the myriad legal issues related to air property ownership, including clearing title, for example, and estate planning. And one of those ways that we'll do the estate planning and title clearing work is that in the December of last year, my predecessor and the staff at the Federation hosted our annual air property conference. And there were 100 air property owners identified that had legal issues. And we gave them a checklist of things that they can work on independently. And we are going to be working with them to ensure that they get sufficient sufficient and adequate legal services to addressing whatever their specific needs are. One of the ways we will do that is through our internship program. So our interns start next Monday, and in partnership with John Deere and the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, they'll be getting a training that I wish I had when I started out practicing on exactly how to, you know, work with air property owners, because, you know, you're not dealing with a client that you can have, you know, send a quick email all the time. They might not have internet access, right? And so there are specific needs that they have. One of our thing, one of our service delivery methods will be a mobile wills clinic, where we'll actually travel to where the farmland is located to help with the collection of the documents that are necessary for clearing title and having a comprehensive estate plan. So that's a big project that we'll be working on this summer and throughout the end of this year. Another thing that I'll be working on is through my role as a mediator for we provide services for folks who have disputes with the USDA program and services. And through that hat, if you will, I'll also be assisting with mediation for air property family members where there's, you know, family disputes around how the land should be managed and what should be done for the next generation. And then finally, under my advocacy hat, I'll serve as the liaison between our members and our members' elected representatives to ensure that their needs are adequately being addressed. For example, the Uniform Partition of Air Property Act needs to be passed in all of the states. And we also want to make sure that we're implementing cooperative formation legislation wherever our members are located, because as you can imagine, cooperative formation is not super popular throughout the Southeast or in a lot of the states where our members are located. So that's something that we definitely want to be addressing right now.
Yeah. And, you know, the core of your position, land retention, and, you know, with the heirs property, you can see this really clearly. It sort of implies preventing the more loss, right? Like making sure people who are potentially going to lose land, that it doesn't happen, that you're stepping in as their legal representative. But what about land that has already been lost? Or what about also, like, you know, getting more Black farmers on land, even if, you know, they don't have a direct lineage that they can trace to, you know, this is land that I love, you know, just getting new Black farmers on land when, if they are interested in farming. Are you looking at those fronts as well?
Absolutely. So the full name of our very long name is the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund. Land Assistance Fund was actually a separate entity. And then in the 80s, it merged with the Federation because of exactly the issue that you identified. We want to ensure that our cooperatives are strong businesses, but we also want to make sure that for the land retention piece, there's money available for keeping the land available for new and emerging Black farmers or farmers, like you said, that haven't historically had access to land. And so we were a part of the advocacy around the implementation of the Heirs Property Relending Program. And that was part of an idea coming out of the Land Assistance Fund for a revolving loan fund where, you know, for example, if a farmer was facing tax sale or partition sale, we could be engaged in, you know, giving them access to money so that they could prevent that loss of land. And so that is kind of written into the 2018 Farm Bill, Fair Access for Farmers and Ranchers Act, but it has not yet been implemented. So that's some of the advocacy work that we're trying to raise awareness around, and we'll definitely be doing a lot of campaigns to make sure that, as you said, there's still opportunities for those who want to get into agriculture to have access to land and to reacquire, if possible, any land that has been previously lost.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you more about the policy front and, you know, the USDA in particular historically has, discriminated against Black farmers. And, you know, you mentioned loans. There's a lot of documentation of how USDA has denied loans to Black farmers systematically over decades and decades, right? So this new legislation that just passed, the American Rescue Plan, allocated $4 billion in debt relief for Black farmers, and then another $1 billion to set up a racial equity commission at the agency. I'm curious what impact you think these recent initiatives might have. Like, are you optimistic about real change at USDA?
So to put it in context, I am coming back from a soft retirement from this work. When I was working at the Land Loss Prevention Project in North Carolina 7 years ago, the administration that came into power in North Carolina cut funding for all of the organizations that were Black-led or historically had been Black-led organizations, which included funding for the work that I was doing in particular. And so I, you know, definitely went into a state of, you know, despair, I guess is the best word personally, because this is work that means everything to me and I'm extremely passionate about. It's very, very important work. And so the past couple years, you know, just looking at the statistics not improving and our community continuing to face the same issues that I set out my legal career to address was very challenging. And what I'm excited about and what kind of brought me back, I've always wanted to work with the Federation. One of the farmers, Ben Burkett in Mississippi, is the reason I even learned about the issue of Black land loss. And so I had always had this goal to work here. And when I saw some of the shifts happening in the administration, I saw some of this legislation, I just felt really, really excited and optimistic of the introduction of this legislation as an acknowledgement of the work that I set out to do, and especially an acknowledgement of the unique challenges facing Black farmers. But I think that these initiatives will only be as effective as they are responsive to the actual needs of Black farmers. And by that, I mean, Black farmers and the organizations like ours that work directly with them need to be fully prioritized and present in any discussions about the rulemaking and implementation of any of this legislation. I think right. For our membership, it means that there's an opportunity to directly advocate and educate the public and our elected officials on the Black farmers' position as first responders. You know, we were, you know, delivering boxes of food. You know, we were on the front lines under COVID. Yes. And we have been historically on the front lines of the racial justice work. A lot of the racial justice for other groups, other socially disadvantaged farmer and rancher groups, comes out of the long history of Black farmers kind of leading that charge and that fight. And so I'm very excited to see that this legislation is being presented. And I hope that the folks that are implementing it acknowledge and address that Black farmers need to be prioritized front and center.
Absolutely. Well, Dania, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about this important issue. I really appreciate it.
Of course. It was such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Lisa.
And thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. Until next time, this is Lisa Held. The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better,
fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.